Welcome to the Pod Cultcast, a podcast where we usually talk about life, love, learning, and libido in polyamory and kink. Also a podcast where occasionally we talk about abuse, violence, and mental health issues. And today, we're going to talk about all of that because we're addressing the Black Lives Matter peaceful protests as well as the Stonewall riots, specifically talking about Marsha P. Johnson, a Black trans who was central to those riots. We understand that this podcast episode may be triggering or traumatizing for you to hear the names of people who have passed or hear content about what's happening. We understand that as part of self-care, you may be taking a social media break and a news break. This is all okay. And we support your efforts to take care of yourself. If you need to stop this podcast episode and go back and listen to one of our other episodes because you really want to hear the pod have a good time, check out podpodcultcast.com. That's cult with a V. And there are a number of episodes on our episodes page that are perfect for you. Chasten here. There's a lot going on. So before we do anything, we're going to take some time to think about some people that have died. I have a list of Black people who have died and some information about their final moments, some information about their lives, and I'm going to share this and read it. And it's going to be a long list because I'm going back to 2014. I will share my sources. This is a list that comes from, that was compiled by NPR. And I will also have two lists from the Human Rights Campaign about not only Black deaths, but Black trans deaths. Eric Garner had just broken up a fight. According to witness testimony, Ezell Ford was walking in the neighborhood. Michelle Cousseau was changing the lock on her home's door when the police arrived to take her to a mental health facility. Tanisha Anderson was having a bad mental health episode, and her brother called 911. Tamir Rice was playing in the park. Natasha McKenna was having a schizophrenic episode when she was tased in Fairfax, Virginia. Walter Scott was going to an auto parts store. Betty Jones answered the door to let Chicago police officers in to help her upstairs neighbor who had called 911 to resolve a domestic dispute. Philando Castile was driving home from dinner with his girlfriend. Botham Jean was eating ice cream in his living room in Dallas. A Tatiana Jefferson was babysitting her nephew at home in Fort Worth, Texas. Eric Reason was pulling into a parking lot at a local chicken and fish shop. Dominique Clayton was sleeping in her bed. Brianna Taylor was also sleeping in her bed. And George Floyd was at the grocery store. Eric Garner, John Crawford III, Michael Brown, Ezell Ford, Dante Parker, Michelle Cousseau, Laquan McDonald, Tanisha Anderson, Akai Gurley, Tamir Rice, Romaine Brisbane, Jerame Reed, George Mann, Matthew Edgebade, Frank Smart, Natasha McKenna, Tony Robinson, Anthony Hill, Maya Hall, Philip White, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, William Chapman II, Alexia Christian, Brendan Glenn, Victor Manuel LaRosa, Jonathan Sanders, Freddie Blue, Joseph Mann, Salvato Ellswood, Sandra Bland, Albert Joseph Davis, Darius Stewart, Billy Ray Davis, Samuel Dubose, Michael Sabby, Brian Keith Day, Christian Taylor, Troy Robinson, Ashams Pharaoh Manley, Felix Kumi, Keith Harrison McLeod, Junior Prosper, Lamonte Jones, Patterson Brown, Dominic Hutchinson, Anthony Ashford, Alonzo Smith, Tyree Crawford, India Kagerd, Levante Biggs, Michael Lee Marshall, Jamar Clark, Richard Perkins, Nathaniel Harris Pickett, Benny Lee Tigner, Michael Espinal, Michael Noel, Kevin Matthews, Betty Jones, Quintonio Legrier, Keith Childress Jr., Janet Wilson, Randy Nelson, Antrony Scott, Wendell Celestine, David Joseph, Kaylin Rokemore, Dejon Perkins, Christopher Davis, Marco Loud, Peter Gaines, Tori Robinson, Darius Robinson, Kevin Hicks, Mary Chuslo, DeMarcus Semmer, Willie Tillman, Terrell Thomas, Sylville Smith, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Terrence Crutcher, Paul O'Neill, Alteria Woods, Jordan Edwards, Aaron Bailey, Ronell Foster, Stephen Clark, Antoine Rose II, Botham Jean, Pamela Turner, Dominique Clayton, Atatiana Jefferson, Christopher Whitfield, Christopher McCorvey, Eric Reason, Michael Lorenzo Dean, Brianna Taylor, George Floyd. In 2019, Dana Martin, age 31, a black transgender woman, was fatally shot in Montgomery, Alabama. Jazlyn Ware, 34, was found dead in her Memphis apartment. She was a beloved friend. Ashanti Carmen, 27, is a black transgender woman who was fatally shot in Prince George's County, Maryland on March 30th, 2019. Her fiancé said, "Until I leave this earth, I'm going to continue on loving her in my body, heart, and soul. She did not deserve to leave the earth so early, especially in the way she went out." Claire Legato, age 21, a black transgender woman, was fatally shot in Cleveland on April 15, 2019. Malaysia Booker, age 23, a black transgender woman, was fatally shot in Dallas, Texas on May 18, 2019. Michelle Tamika Washington, age 40, a black trans woman who was fatally shot in Philadelphia on May 19, 2019. She was remembered by friends and loved ones as a beloved sister and a gay mother. Paris Cameron, 20, a black trans woman, "That's how old my son is," was killed in a horrific anti-LGBTQ shooting in a home in Detroit on May 25th, 2019. Quote, "The two other victims were shot but survived, and this case illustrates the mortal danger faced by members of Detroit's LGBTQ community, including transgender women of color." China Lindsay, age 26, a black trans woman, was found dead in White Rock Lake, Dallas, with signs of homicidal violence on June 1, 2019. Chanel Scurlock, age 23, a black trans woman, was fatally shot in Lumberton, North Carolina. Zoe Spears, age 23, a black trans woman, was found with signs of trauma in Fairmount Heights, Maryland. "She was my daughter, very bright and full of life," transgender advocate Ruby Corrado, the founder and executive director of Casa Ruby, told HRC. Brooklyn Lindsay, age 32, a black trans woman, found in Kansas City. Denali's
Denali Barry Stuckey, age 29, a black trans woman, found fatally shot in North Charleston, South Carolina. Tracy Single, 22, a black trans woman, killed in Houston, Texas on July 30th. Bubba Walker, age 55, a black trans woman, killed in Charlotte, North Carolina, late July, reported missing on July 26th. Remembered by friends and family as one of those people who was really fun to be around. She was very kind, and she loved helping people. Kiki Fontroy, 21, a black trans woman, was fatally shot in Miami, Florida on July 31st. Her mother remembered her as having a heart of gold, and she also pleaded for justice for her daughter, saying, "My baby, my baby. Please help bring justice to my baby." Pebbles LaDime Dime Doe, a black trans woman, killed in Allendale County, South Carolina, on August 4th, 2019. Bailey Reeves, age 17, a black trans teen, was fatally shot in Baltimore, Maryland on September 2nd. 17. Jamagio Jamar Berryman, a black gender nonconforming person, was killed in Kansas City, Kansas on September 13th. Itali Marlowe, 29, a black trans woman, was found shot in Houston on September 20th. Monica Diamond, age 34, a black trans woman, was killed in North Carolina on March 18th, was the co-CEO of the International Mother of the Year pageantry system, a pageant that honors LGBTQ mothers. Nina Pop, a black trans woman, was killed in Sikeston, Missouri on May 3rd. Tony McDade, a black trans man, was killed in Tallahassee, Florida on May 27th. His friends and family shared how he was an energetic, giving person with a big heart. I had to take a break from recording because I'm a human being and reading the lists of murdered names is hard. But it's even harder to be a black person in our country and be murdered. To not be able to walk out your door and wonder if what you're doing is going to get you pulled over or shot. Today is June 2nd. It is the second day of Pride. I want to talk about Marsha P. Johnson and the Stonewall Riots. I'm just going to read something to you about Marsha P. Johnson. I think that it's important that we understand what people, who people were. This is from an article on CNN from last year, and I'll share the link and my resources. She was on the front lines of protests against oppressive policing. She helped found one of the country's first safe spaces for transgender and homeless youth, and she advocated tirelessly on behalf of sex workers. Marsha P. Johnson was a sex worker herself. Prisoners and people with HIV/AIDS, all while draped in dashing outfits and flower headpieces, and armed people who knew her would say, with a vibrant smile. The nobody from Nowheresville, as she self-described, she adopted the name Marsha P. Johnson. The P, she told people, stood for Pay It No Mind. She played a key role in the uprising that began on June 28, 1969, at the Stonewall Inn in New York's Greenwich Village, after police raided a gay bar, and the patrons fought back. Fought back. Sometimes peaceful protests don't work. I want to address what happened in the Rose Garden last night, and some of the responses I'm seeing from governors are great. What will be known as the Trump Rose Garden. Gosh. Sorry, I'm tired. And I'm not going to edit it out. What would be known as the Trump Rose Garden speech to declare war on the United States. He specifically said that he was defending the Second Amendment, which I believe is coded speak for taking up arms and forming militias. And I think that it is going to become far more dangerous in our country for peaceful protesters. So I want everybody to stay safe out there. Please stay safe out there. I'm trying not to ramble through this episode, and I'm trying to give you good quality Black Lives Matter support content. So here is Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham prison in its entirety. Listen to it all. April 16th, 1963. A letter from Birmingham Jail from Martin Luther King Jr. My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in Birmingham, in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities, quote, unwise and untimely, unquote. Seldom do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all the criticisms that cross my desk, my secretaries would have little time for anything other than such correspondence in the course of the day, and I would have no time for constructive work. But since I feel that you are the men of genuine good will, and your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. I think I should indicate why I am here in Birmingham, since you have been influenced by the view which argues against, quote, outsiders coming in, unquote. I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization operating in every southern state with headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia. We have some 85 affiliated organizations across the South, and one of them is the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. Frequently, we share staff, educational, and financial resources with our affiliates. Several months ago, the affiliate here in Birmingham asked us to be on call to engage in a nonviolent direct action program, if such were deemed necessary. We readily consented, and when the hour came, we lived up to our promise. So I, along with several members of my staff, am here because I was invited here. I am here because I have organizational ties here. But more basically, I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. Just as the prophets of the 8th century BC left their villages and carried their, quote, thus saith the Lord, unquote, far beyond the boundaries of their hometowns, and just as the Apostle Paul left his village of Tarsus and carried the gospel of Jesus Christ to far corners of the Greco-Roman world, so am I compelled to carry the gospel of freedom beyond my own hometown. Like Paul, I must constantly respond to the Macedonian call for aid. Moreover, I'm cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. Never again can we afford to live with the narrow, provincial, quote, outside agitator, unquote, idea. Anyone who lives inside the United States can never be considered an outsider anywhere within its bounds. You deplore the demonstrations taking place in Birmingham, but your statement, I am sorry to say, fails to express similar concern for the conditions that brought about the demonstrations. I'm sure that none of you would want to rest content with the superficial kind of social analysis that deals merely with the effects and does not grapple with the underlying causes. It is unfortunate that demonstrations are taking place in Birmingham, but it is even more unfortunate that the city's white power structure left the Negro community with no alternative. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts to determine whether injustices exist. Negotiation. Self-purification. And direct action. We have gone through all these steps in Birmingham. There can be no gainsaying the fact that racial injustice engulfs this community. Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of brutality is widely known. Negroes have experienced grossly unjust treatment in the courts. There have been more unsolved bombings of Negro homes and churches in Birmingham than in any other city in the nation. These are hard, brutal facts of the case. On the basis of these conditions, Negro leaders sought to negotiate with the city fathers, but the latter consistently refused to engage in good faith negotiation. Then last September came the opportunity to talk with leaders of Birmingham's economic community. In the course of the negotiations, certain promises were made by the merchants, for example, to remove the store's humiliating racial signs. On the basis of these promises, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and the leaders of the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights agreed to a moratorium on all demonstrations. And as the weeks and months went by, we realized we were the victims of a broken promise. A few signs, briefly removed, returned. The others remained. As in so many past experiences, our hopes have been blasted and the shadow of deep disappointment settled upon us. We had no alternative except to prepare for direct action, whereby we would present our very bodies as means of laying our case before the conscience of the local and national community. Mindful of the difficulties involved, we decided to undertake a process of self-purification. We began a series of workshops on nonviolence, and we repeatedly asked ourselves, are you able to accept blows without retaliating? Are you able to endure the ordeal of jail? We decided to schedule our direct action program for the Easter season, realizing that except for Christmas, this is the main shopping period of the year, knowing that a strong economic withdrawal program would be byproduct of direct action. We felt that this would be the best time to bring pressure to bear on the merchants for a needed change. Then it occurred to us that Birmingham's mayoral election was coming up in March, and we speedily decided to postpone action until after Election Day. When we discovered that the Commissioner of Public Safety, Eugene Bull Connor, had piled up enough votes to be in the runoff, we decided to postpone action until the day after the runoff so that the demonstrations could not be used to cloud the issues. And like many others, we waited to see Mr. Connor defeated. And to have this end, we endured postponement after postponement. Having aided in this community need, we felt our direct action program could be delayed no longer. You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. My citing the creation of tension as part of the work of the nonviolent resistor may sound rather shocking, but I must confess that I am not afraid of the word, quote, tension, unquote. I have earnestly opposed violent tension, but there is a type of constructive, nonviolent tension, which is necessary for growth. Just as Socrates felt that it was necessary to create a tension in the mind so that individuals could rise from the bondage of myth and half-truths to the unfettered realm of creative analysis and objective appraisal, so must we see the need for nonviolent gadflies to create the kind of tension in society that will help men rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism to the majestic heights of understanding and brotherhood. The purpose of our direct action program is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. I therefore concur with you in your call for negotiation. Too long has our beloved Southland been bogged down in a tragic effort to live in monologue rather than dialogue. One of the basic points in your statement is that the action I and my associates have taken in Birmingham is untimely. Some have asked, why didn't you give the new city administration time to act? The only answer I can give to this query is that the new Birmingham administration must be prodded about as much as the outgoing one before it will act. We are sadly mistaken if we feel that the election of Albert Boutwell as mayor will bring the millennium to Birmingham. While Mr. Boutwell is a much more gentle person than Mr. Connor, they are both segregationists, dedicated to the maintenance of the status quo. I have hope that Mr. Boutwell will be reasonable enough to see the futility of massive resistance to desegregation, but he will not see this without pressure from devotees of civil rights. My friends, I must say to you that we have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. Lamentably, it is an historical fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see the moral light and involuntarily give up their unjust posture, but as Reinhold Niebuhr has reminded us, groups tend to be more immoral than individuals. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. Frankly, I have yet to engage in a direct action campaign that was, quote, well-timed, unquote, in the view of those who have not suffered unduly from the disease of segregation. For years now, I've heard the word, wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with piercing familiarity. This, wait, has almost always meant never. We must come to see with one of our distinguished jurists that, quote, justice too long delayed is justice denied, unquote. We have waited for more than 340 years for our constitutional and God-given rights. The nations of Asia and Africa are moving with jet-like speed toward gaining political independence, but we still creep at horse and buggy pace toward gaining a cup of coffee at lunch counters. Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. But when you have seen vicious mobs lynch your mothers and fathers at will and drown your sisters and brothers at whim, when you have seen hate-filled policemen curse, kick, and even kill your black brothers and sisters, when you have seen the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she can't go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see tears welling up in her eyes, when she's told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see ominous clouds of inferiority beginning to form in her little mental sky, and see her beginning to distort her personality by developing an unconscious bitterness towards white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son who is asking, Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean? When you take a cross-country drive and find it necessary to sleep night after night in the uncomfortable corners of your automobile because no motel will accept you. When you are humiliated day in and day out by nagging signs reading white and colored. When your first name becomes, quote, the N-word, not gonna say it, unquote. Your middle name becomes boy, however old you are, and your last name becomes John, and your wife and your mother are never given the respected title Mrs. When you are harried day and haunt by day and haunted by night, the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never quite knowing what to expect next, and are plagued with inner fears and outer resentments. When you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of, quote, nobodiness,
unquote, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. There comes a time when the cup of endurance runs over, and men are no longer willing to be plunged into the abyss of despair. I hope, sirs, you can understand our legitimate and unavoidable impatience. You express a great deal of anxiety over our willingness to break laws. This is certainly a legitimate concern, since we so diligently urge the people to obey the Supreme Court's decision of 1954 outlawing segregation in public schools. At first glance, it may seem rather paradoxical for us to consciously to break laws. One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal but moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with the moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. All segregation statutes are unjust because segregation distorts the soul and damages the personality. It gives the segregator a false sense of superiority and the segregated a false sense of inferiority. Segregation, to use the terminology of a Jewish philosopher, Martin Buber, substitutes an I-it relationship for an I-thou relationship and ends up relegating persons to the status of things. Hence, segregation is not only politically, economically, and sociologically unsound, it is morally wrong and sinful. Paul Tillich has said that sin is separation. Is not segregation an existential expression of man's tragic separation, his awful estrangement? Is not segregation an existential expression of man's tragic separation, his awful estrangement, his terrible sinfulness? Thus, it is that I can urge men to obey the 1954 decision of the Supreme Court, for it's morally right, and I can urge them to disobey segregation ordinances, for they are morally wrong. Let us consider a more concrete example of just and unjust laws. An unjust law is a code that a numerical or power majority group compels a minority group to obey, but does not make binding on itself. This is a difference made legal. By the same token, a just law is a code that a majority compels a minority to follow and that it is willing to follow itself. This is sameness made legal. Let me give another explanation. A law is unjust if it is inflicted on a minority that, as a result of being denied the right to vote, had no part in enacting or devising the law. Who can say that the legislature of Alabama, which set up the state segregation laws, was democratically elected? Throughout Alabama, all sorts of devious methods are used to prevent Negroes from becoming registered voters, and there are some counties in which, even though Negroes constitute a majority of the population, not a single one is registered. Can any law enacted under such circumstances be considered democratically structured? Sometimes a law is just on its face and unjust and in its Sometimes a law is just on its face and unjust in its application. For instance, I've been arrested on a charge of parading without a permit. Now, there's nothing wrong with having an ordinance which requires a permit for a parade, but such an ordinance becomes unjust when it's used to maintain segregation and deny citizens the First Amendment privilege of peaceful assembly and protest. I hope you're able to see the distinction I'm trying to point out. In no sense do I advocate evading or defying the law, as would the rabid segregationist. That would lead to anarchy. One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty. I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. Of course, there is nothing new about this kind of civil disobedience. It was evident sublimely in the refusal of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to obey the laws of Nebuchadnezzar on the ground that a higher moral law was at stake. It was practiced superbly by the early Christians who were willing to face hungry lions and the excruciating pain of chopping blocks rather than submit to certain unjust laws of the Roman Empire. To a degree, academic freedom is a reality today because Socrates practiced civil disobedience in our own nation. The Boston Tea Party represented a massive act of civil disobedience. We should never forget that everything Adolf Hitler did in Germany was quote-unquote legal, and everything the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary was quote-unquote illegal. It was illegal to aid and comfort the Jew in Hitler's Germany. Even so, I'm sure that had I lived in Germany at the time, I would have aided and comforted my Jewish brothers. If today I lived in a communist country where certain principles dear to the Christian faith are suppressed, I would openly advocate disobeying that country's anti-religious laws. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the past few years, I've been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, "Well, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree to your methods of direct action," who paternalistically believes he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by a mythical concept of time, who constantly advises the Negro to wait for a more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that law and order exist for the purpose of establishing justice, that when they fail in this purpose, they become dangerously structured dams that block the flow of social progress. I had hoped that the white moderate would understand that the present tension in the South is a necessary phase of the transition from an obnoxious negative peace, in which the Negro passively accepted his unjust plight, to a substantive and positive peace in which all men will respect the dignity and worth of human personality. Actually, we who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creators of tension. We merely bring to surface the hidden tension, which is already alive. We bring it out in the open where it can be seen and dealt with, like a boil that can never be cured so long as it's covered up, but must be opened up with all of its ugliness and to the natural medicines of the air and light, and injustice must be exposed with all the tension its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. In your statement, you assert that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. But is this a logical assertion? Isn't this like condemning a robbed man because his possession of money precipitated the evil act of robbery? Isn't this like condemning Socrates because his unswerving commitment to truth and his philosophical inquiries precipitated the act of the misguided populace in which they made him drink hemlock? Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God consciousness and never-ceasing devotion to God's will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? We must come to see that, as the federal courts have consistently affirmed, it's wrong to urge an individual to cease efforts to gain his basic constitutional rights because the quest may precipitate violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber. I had also hoped that the white moderate would reject the myth concerning time in relation to the struggle for freedom. I've just received a letter from a white brother in Texas. He writes, quote, "All Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but it is possible that you are in too great a religious hurry. It has taken Christianity almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to earth." Unquote. Such an attitude stems from a tragic misconception of time. From the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time itself is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. More and more, I feel that the people of ill will have used time much more effectively than the people of goodwill. We'll have to repent in this generation not merely for the hateful words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. Human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. We must use time creatively, and the knowledge that the time is always ripe to do right. Now is the time to make real the promise of democracy, and transform our pending national elegy to a creative psalm of brotherhood. Now is the time to lift our national policy from the quicksand of racial injustice to the solid rock of human dignity. You speak of our activity in Birmingham as extreme? At first, I was rather disappointed that fellow clergymen would see my nonviolent efforts as those of an extremist. I began thinking about the fact that I stand in the middle of two opposing forces in the Negro community. One is a force of complacency, made up in part of Negroes who, as a result of long years of oppression, are so drained of self-respect and a sense of somebody-ness that they have adjusted to segregation. And in part, a few middle-class Negroes who, because of a degree of academic and economic security, have and because in some ways they profit by segregation, have become insensitive to the problems of the masses. The other force is one of bitterness and hatred, and it comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in the various black nationalist groups that are springing up across the nation. The largest and best known being Elijah Muhammad's Muslim movement. Nourished by the Negro's frustration over the continued existence of racial discrimination, this movement is made up of people who have lost faith in America, who have absolutely repudiated Christianity, and who have concluded that the white man is an incorrigible devil. I've tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need emulate neither the do-nothingism of the complacent nor the hatred and despair of the black nationalist, for there is the more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I'm grateful to God that through the influence of the Negro church, the way of nonviolence became an integral part of our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, by now many streets of the South would, I'm convinced, be flowing with blood. And I'm further convinced that if our white brothers dismiss as rabble-rousers and outside agitators, those of us who employ nonviolent direct action. And if they refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, millions of Negroes will, out of frustration and despair, seek solace and security in Black nationalist ideologies, a development that would inevitably lead to a frightening racial nightmare. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning for freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded him that it can be gained. Consciously or unconsciously, he has been caught up by the zeitgeist, and with his Black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers of Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, the United States Negro is moving with a sense of great urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. If one recognizes this vital urge that has engulfed the community, one should readily understand why public demonstrations are taking place. The Negro has many pent-up resentments and latent frustrations, and he must release them. So let him march. Let him make prayer pilgrimages to the city hall. Let him go on freedom rides and try to understand why he must do so. If his repressed emotions are not released in nonviolent ways, they will seek expression through violence. This is not a threat, but a fact of history. So I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Rather, I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled into the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. And now this approach is being termed extremist. But though I was initially disappointed at being categorized as an extremist, as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a measure of satisfaction from the label. Was that Jesus? An extremist for love. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you. And pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the Christian gospel? I bear in my body the marks of Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. So help me God. And John Bunyan, I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a butchery of my conscience. And Abraham Lincoln, this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. And Thomas Jefferson, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate or for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice or for the extension of justice? In that dramatic scene on Calvary's Hill, three men were crucified. We must never forget that all three were crucified for the same crime. The crime of extremism. Two were extremists for immorality and thus fell below their environment. The other, Jesus Christ, was an extremist for love, truth, and goodness, and thereby rose above his environment. Perhaps the South, the nation, and the world are in dire need of creative extremists. I had hoped that the white moderate would see this need. Perhaps I was too optimistic. Perhaps I expected too much. I suppose I should have realized that a few members of the oppressor race can understand the deep groans and passionate yearnings of the oppressed race, and still fewer have a vision to see that injustice must be rooted out by strong, persistent, and determined action. I am thankful, however, that some of our white brothers in the South have grasped the meaning of this social revolution and committed themselves to it. They are still all too few in quantity, but they are big in quality. Some such as Ralph McGill, Lillian Smith, Harry Golden, James McBride, Dabbs, Ann Braden, and Sarah Patton Boyle have written about our struggle in eloquent and prophetic terms. Others have marched with us down nameless streets in the South. They have languished in filthy, roach-infested jails, suffering the abuse and brutality of policemen who view them as dirty, blank word lovers. Unlike so many of their moderate brothers and sisters, they have recognized the urgency of the moment and sensed the need for powerful action antidotes to combat the disease of segregation. Let me take note of my other major disappointment. I have been so greatly disappointed with the white church and its leadership. Of course, there are some notable exceptions. I am not unmindful of the fact that each of you has taken some significant stands on the issue. I commend you, Reverend Stallings, for your Christian stand on this past Sunday, in welcoming Negroes to your worship service on a non-segregated basis. I commend the Catholic leaders of this state for integrating Spring Hill College several years ago. But despite these noble exceptions, I must honestly reiterate that I have been disappointed with the church. I do not say this as one of those negative critics who can always find something wrong with the church. I say this as a minister of the gospel who loves the church, who was nurtured in its bosom, who has been sustained by its spiritual blessings, and who will remain true to it as long as the cord of life shall lengthen. When I was suddenly catapulted into leadership of the bus protest in Montgomery, Alabama a few years ago, I felt I'd be supported by the white church. I felt that white ministers, priests, rabbis of the South would be among our strongest allies. Instead, some have been outright opponents, refusing to understand the freedom movement and misrepresenting its leaders. All too many others have been more cautious than courageous and have remained silent behind the anesthetizing security of stained-glass windows. In spite of my shattered dreams, I came to Birmingham with the hope that the white religious leadership of this community would see the justice of our cause and, with deep moral concern, would serve as the channel through which our just grievances could reach the power structure. I had hoped that each of you would understand, but again, I have been disappointed. I have heard numerous Southern religious leaders admonish their worshipers to comply with a desegregation decision because it is the law, but I have longed to hear white ministers declare, quote, follow this decree because integration is morally right and because the Negro is your brother. In the midst of blatant injustices inflicted upon the Negro. I have watched white churchmen stand on the sideline and mouth pious irrelevancies and sanctimonious trivialities in the midst of a mighty struggle to rid our nation of racial and economic justice. I've heard many ministers say those are social issues with which the gospel has no real concern. And I have watched many churches commit themselves to completely otherworldly religion, which makes a strange, unbiblical distinction between body and soul, between the sacred and the secular. I've traveled at the length and breadth of Alabama and Mississippi and all the other southern states on sweltering summer days and crisp autumn mornings. I have looked at the South's beautiful churches with their lofty spires pointing heavenward. I have beheld the impressive outlines of her massive religious education buildings. Over and over, I have found myself asking, what kind of people worship here? Who is their God? Where were their voices when the lips of Governor Barnett dripped with words of interposition and nullification? Where were they when Governor Wallace gave a clarion call for defiance and hatred? Where were their voices of support when bruised and weary Negro men and women decided to rise from the dark dungeons of complacency to the bright hills of creative protest? Yes, these questions are still on my mind. In deep disappointment, I have wept over the laxity of the church, but be assured that my tears have been tears of love. There can be no deep disappointment where there is not deep love. Yes, I love the church. How could I do otherwise? I'm in a rather unique position, being the son, the grandson, and the great-grandson of preachers. Yes, I see the church as the body of Christ, but oh, How we have blemished and scarred that body through social neglect and fear of being nonconformists. There was a time when the church was very powerful, and the time when early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer for what recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was the thermostat that transformed the mores of society. And whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But the Christians pressed on, and in conviction that they were a colony of heaven, called to obey God rather than man. Small in number, they were big in commitment, and they were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. By their effort and example, they brought an end to such ancient evils as infanticide and gladiatorial contests. Things are different now. So often, the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. So often it is an arch defender of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's silent and often even vocal sanction of things as they are. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. Every day I meet young people whose disappointment with the church has turned to outright disgust. Perhaps I once again have been too optimistic. Is organized religion too intrinsically bound to the status quo to save our nation and the world? Perhaps I must turn my faith to the inner spiritual church, the church within the church, as the true ecclesia and the hope of the world. But again, I am thankful to God that some noble souls from the ranks of organized religion have broken loose from the paralyzing chains of conformity and joined us as active partners in the struggles for freedom. They have left their secure congregations and walked the streets of Albany, Georgia with us. They have gone down the highways of the South on torturous rides for freedom. Yes, they have gone to jail with us. Some have been dismissed from their churches, have lost support of their bishops and fellow ministers. But they have acted in the faith that the right defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. Their witness has been the spiritual salt that has preserved the true meaning of the gospel in these troubled times, and they have carved a tunnel of hope through the dark mountain of disappointment. I hope the church as a whole will meet the challenge of this decisive hour, but even if the church does not come to the aid of justice, I have no despair about the future. I have no fear about the outcome of struggle in Birmingham, even if our motives at present are misunderstood. We will reach that goal of freedom in Birmingham and all over the nation, because the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up with America's destiny. Before the Pilgrims landed in Plymouth, we were here. Before the pen of Jefferson etched the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence across the pages of history, we were here. For more than two centuries, our forebears labored in this country without wages. They made cotton king. They built homes of their masters while suffering gross injustice and a shameful humiliation. And yet, out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to thrive and develop. If the inexpressible cruelties of slavery could not stop us, the opposition we now face will surely fail. We will win our freedom because the sacred heritage of our nation and eternal will of God are embodied in our echoing demands. Before closing, I feel impelled to mention one other point in your statement that has troubled me profoundly. You warmly commended the Birmingham police force for keeping order and preventing violence. I doubt that you would have so warmly commended the police force if you had seen its dogs sinking their teeth into unarmed nonviolent Negroes. I doubt that you would so quickly commend the police if you were to observe their ugly and inhumane treatment of Negroes here in city jail, if you were to watch them push and curse old Negro women and young Negro girls, if you were to see them slap and kick old Negro men and young boys, if you were to observe them, as they did on two occasions, refuse to give us food because we wanted to sing our grace together, I cannot join you in your praise of the Birmingham Police Department. It is true that the police have exercised a degree of discipline in handling the demonstrators. In this sense, they have conducted themselves rather, quote, nonviolently, unquote, in public. But for what purpose? To preserve the evil system of segregation. Over the past few years, I've consistently preached that nonviolence demands that means we use must be as pure as the ends we seek. I've tried to make clear that it is wrong to use immoral means to attain moral ends, but I now must affirm that it is just as wrong, or perhaps even more so, to use moral means to preserve immoral ends. Perhaps Mr. Connor and his policemen have been rather nonviolent in public, as was Chief Pritchett in Albany, Georgia, but they have used the moral means of nonviolence to maintain the immoral end of racial injustice. As T.S. Eliot has said, the last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. I wish you had commended the Negro sit-iners and demonstrators of Birmingham for their sublime courage, their willingness to suffer, and their amazing discipline in the midst of great provocation. One day, the South will recognize its real heroes. They will be the James Merediths, with the noble sense of purpose that enables them to face jeering and hostile mobs, and with the agonizing loneliness that characterizes the life of the pioneer. They will be old, oppressed, battered Negro women, symbolized in 72-year-old in this, a 72-year-old woman in Montgomery, Alabama, who rose up with a sense of dignity and with her people decided not to ride segregated buses, and who responded with ungrammatical profundity to one who inquired about her weariness. "My feet is tired, but my soul is at rest." They will be the young high school and college students, the young ministers of the gospel, and a host of their elders, courageously and nonviolently sitting in at lunch counters and willingness to go to jail for conscience' sake. One day, the South will know that when they were in reality standing up for what is best in the American dream and for the most sacred values in our Judeo-Christian heritage, thereby bringing our nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug by the founding fathers in their formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Never before have I written so long a letter. I'm afraid it's much too long to take your precious time, and I can assure you that it would have been much shorter if I'd been writing from a comfortable desk. But what else can one do when he is alone in a narrow jail cell, other than write long letters, think long thoughts, and pray long prayers? If I've said anything in this letter that overstates the truth and indicates an unreasonable impatience, I beg you to forgive me. If I've said anything that understates the truth and indicates my having a patience that allows me to settle for anything less than brotherhood, I beg God to forgive me. I hope this letter finds you strong in the faith. I also hope that circumstances will soon make it possible for me to meet each of you, not as an integrationist or a civil rights leader, but as a fellow clergyman and Christian brother. Let us all hope that the dark clouds of racial prejudice will soon pass away, and the deep fog of misunderstanding will be lifted from our fear-drenched communities, and in some not-too-distant tomorrow the radiant stars of love and brotherhood will shine over the great nation with all their scintillating beauty. Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood, Martin Luther King, Jr. Again, that was a letter from a Birmingham jail written on the 16th of April, 1963, to the white clergyman of Birmingham, Alabama. That letter was not meant to inspire black people to nonviolent protest. It was not meant to chide black people for feeling angry. In fact, it said that it was okay to feel your feelings. which is very progressive for the time, especially. But that letter was to white people to say, hey, your silence says everything. Your centrist views say everything. And I'm disappointed. I'm compassionate, but I'm disappointed. And I'm hurt and angry, but I'm disappointed, but I'm still compassionate. I'm a Christian. I joke that I'm an octo-episcopagan. I'm a Christian, and I don't expect anybody to share my beliefs. But here's a nutshell. I believe in the historical Christ who flipped tables and preached compassion and love as opposed to purity. I think it is important to be compassionate, and I think it is important to show love. And that is what MLK is doing here. MLK is saying, hey, I kind of expected better from my fellow clergymen. I expected love, and here I get hate. Huh. So the reason I shared this letter is because there have been a lot of people who have used Martin Luther King as an example of somebody who says, oh, well, protests shouldn't get violent. Oh, well, protests shouldn't be this. And oh, well, Martin Luther King wouldn't approve. Well, hey, here's the thing. Martin Luther King does approve of protesting. Martin Luther King does understand that sometimes it gets messy. And Martin Luther King does understand that people are angry and that anger explodes sometimes, especially in communities, and says it's okay. And says, hey, white people, like, look, we're telling you, we've been reaching out, we've been negotiating. And Martin Luther King tells the tale in this letter of negotiating about these signs being taken down, the signs not being taken down very long or not being taken down at all. So that was step two of their tactic. Remember, he said they had four steps. They went ahead and proceeded to their next steps in their nonviolent protest process. They prepared. And then they protested nonviolently. And he said, we had to protest nonviolently because our negotiation didn't work. So we protest nonviolently so that you then will be so inspired to negotiate with us again. And that's what the clergymen were asking for, was more negotiation. Well, why didn't you just tell us you were unhappy? Well, we've been telling you all along, and we had these negotiations, and we said that, hey, we'd settle down if you would do this thing that was hurting us, or you would stop doing this thing that would hurt us, that was hurting us. So I think, you know, that we have this cycle that we've seen over and over in America, and now we have a time where, hey, we've been negotiating. Black people have been negotiating. Black people have been laying down and saying, I can't breathe. And now people prepared, and then people are nonviolently protesting. You ask me, Chasten, I am somebody who cannot go out and protest, but my heart is with the Black Lives Matter movement. I believe that Black Lives Matter. I want to help. How can I help? How can I help heal? How can I help protest? Well, I have answers. So, I'm disabled. I'm in bed right now. I'm having horrible asthma issues, horrible pain issues, horrible PTSD issues, all kinds of issues because yay pandemic, woo, all this stuff, not causing my asthma, that's allergies, but the PTSD and the increased stress leading to the increased pain and the inability to be mindful, all that stuff, yay pandemic. So, hi, I'm here to tell you that you can help in lots of ways. The first way you can help is Google. Use Google. So here's what you're going to search for in Google. You're going to search for colorism. You're going to search for paper bag test. You're going to search for whether the police in your city or town have body cams and whether they are required to turn those cams on as soon as they are engaged in a call. And if they are not, you are going to write to your representatives in that city. And on social media, you're going to encourage other people to do the same thing and say, hey, our police are not equipped with body cams, or they're not required to have their body cams on. We need to change this. Let's do it. The next thing you need to do is make sure that your police force is trained in alternative methods. Rather than just their police training, there are de-escalation methods. I'm not familiar with all of them. However, I'm going to be providing a link in the show notes to basically this whole list of things that I'm rattling off that I just have on top of my head. This is just all coming from my brain right now. I'm doing my best. So there will be a link. Go use the links. And you can get there at www.podpodcultcast.com. That's cult with a V. And it will be the episode show notes. You can support the Black Lives Matter movement. You can go to blacklivesmatter.com. First of all, they have gear. You can purchase shirts, but they have a deal with FUBU. They have some really cool merch. If you're somebody who likes to get merch for your money, fine. Order some merch. Wear it to a protest or take a picture of you in it to show that you support the Black Lives Matter movement. There, done. You just supported the Black Lives Matter movement. Put a hashtag in it. You have just signal boosted that you are somebody who is an ally, and now the people in your life who are of color know that you are an ally. Bam, done. Your Facebook picture, your Facebook presence, your Twitter, your social media presence. Instead of sticking to your social media content calendar, you can take a break to post about what's happening. It doesn't have to be excessive. It doesn't have to be more than a post, but you could share a link to where to donate to, say, bail funds in your city. There are bail funds for people who are protesting. You can look up whether there's a bail fund. I will also have a link to I think it's a Google document or a spreadsheet, one of the two, that has a list of bail funds around the country that you can donate to. There's also the ACLU. There are so many organizations. Oh my gosh. So you can take your money out of Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is responsible for some of the bullshit at Standing Rock. And so if you take your money from Wells Fargo, you're hurting them. We need to do that. You can take care of yourself. Self-care is a radical act. If you take care of yourself, then you can take care of your family. If you're taking care of your family, then you can take care of your community. If you take care of your community, then you can take care of the world. And then the world will take care of you, and the community will take care of you, and your friends will take care of you, and your family will take care of you, and you are taking care of you. And it's a big cycle and it's a system that feeds itself. But right now, our world isn't taking care of itself, and our community isn't taking care of itself. And so you have to be taking care of yourself, and you and your family have to be taking care of yourselves. So be safe out there. Now, it is possible that there could be protesting in your city or town. So Google things like police scanner or Twitter police scanner. Some localities have their police calls up on the website. You can see where the police are being sent to. Also, you can follow Twitter, Black Lives Matter locally, or check out local TikTok Black Lives Matter groups in your area. Also, there you can find Discord servers that have information so that you are able to know where the protests are happening, so that if you have to go out and about, you can avoid getting caught up in traffic or avoid them and avoid confusion. Especially if you're disabled like I am, it would be a really bad thing for me to get caught up in any kind of gassing right now. So you can, you know, let the protesters have their space. Let's see. You can not make assumptions about what's happening with the protest unless you know. Do not assume that the protesters are ones setting fires and looting. I've said it before, I'll say it again. There are two sets of people. There are the people who are protesting peacefully, and then there are the people who are setting fires and looting. And most of that has been proven to be either police activity or white nationalist. So, hey. Other things you can do. You can make sure that people in your family who are going out to protest are properly equipped. There are some lists of how to dress and how to prepare for going out to a protest that could be helpful and useful for your friends and family that you may want to share on social media as a friends-only post, so it's not public, so that you're not targeted by the police later on. You can share tips and tricks with your friends and family. A really huge tip is that if you see video footage or pictures from protests, don't share them if they have somebody's face in them. If they're not wearing a mask and they're visible and identifiable and you share it, they could be subject to prosecution or doxing or what have you. So make sure that you're putting a little smiley face over it. You know, do your due diligence to protect protesters. Let's see. So the responsible sharing. Oh, about responsible sharing. Right now, there are lots of videos of violence against Black people going around. Black people are super traumatized. Yes. And I mean, can you imagine like 400 years of generational trauma and also this and also this and also this, and then you share something on Facebook that just triggers all of it? Put a content warning on something, or decide whether it's whether you need to share the video itself or just your thoughts on the video. And also understand kind of your place. If you're white, yeah, it's okay to feel the feelings. It's okay to be sad, and it's okay to want to support and be an ally. But make sure that you're not being louder than the Black voices that are trying to be heard right now. And that's hard. It's a hard place and it's a hard balance. And some Black people are going to tell you, hey, I want you to yell loud and support me. And some Black people are going to tell you, hey, like, don't use the Black power fist. That's just for us. And you need to sit down. And you know what? You're going to have to just suss that out for yourselves. If Black people on social media have social media movements that they're doing or outages, participate in them. What can it hurt? Let's see. Boycott businesses that use prison labor. That's a big one. There's going to be a list in one of the links that I send. There'll be a list of 75 things you can do to help with the systemic racism that we've all been raised with. Another thing to do, and this is something that I struggle with, not because I like it's hard for me to shed, but it's just like a white guilt thing. Like, we were all raised in this society in America to be racist. So I have internalized racism. And if you're white, you're racist. You have something that you do that is racist. It could be as simple as, I don't know, gosh. I mean, it could be as simple as like holding on to your keys a little tighter or like locking your door or something. It could be some small thing that has just like you try to shed it, but it's there. And it's just the systemic indoctrination of racism. And the thing that you need to do is not say, I'm not racist, I don't see color. The thing you need to do is say, I am racist, and society made me this way. So my first thought is maybe a racist thought. So how can I challenge that thought? How can I challenge the programming I've received? How can I challenge my domestication? If you've read the four agreements, you know what I'm talking about. I'm reading the fifth agreement right now. We'll put a link in the show notes. Do you recommend? So how can I challenge these thoughts inside me? And the last thing you can do as a white ally or as somebody who cannot attend a protest is decide how much energy you have to share for individual people. People who are discriminated against have no responsibility to educate you. Use Google. Like, use your resources. For our Black listeners, you have no responsibility to educate us. For our listeners of color, you have no responsibility to educate us. For our white listeners, stop asking Black people and people of color to educate you. You don't need to ask them. You have Google. There have been lots of essays and books and great resources written, and then we'll put them all in the links. There are so many movies you can watch. 12 Years a Slave, again, 13th, lots of stuff. So there are stuff that you can do to support Black art, Black businesses, Black charities, Black kids, Black Lives Matter. There's stuff you can do. So if you're sitting at home and you're feeling guilty and helpless, stop. Just stop it. Don't feel sorry for yourselves. Stop it. You know what you should be doing? You should be taking care of yourselves and being compassionate with yourselves and going, okay, what's one thing I can do today? So, what's the one thing you're going to do today? The one thing I did today was I slapped together some sloppy research and lists and this is the thing I could do. I'm going to edit this episode and try and make it less rambly. So this is the thing I'm going to do today. And tomorrow I'm going to release that episode, and that's the thing I'm going to do tomorrow. And I'm going to tell myself that it is what I can do, and I need to be compassionate with myself because that's the limit. That's what I've got. That's what I've got to give. And so what can you do today? Can you educate yourself today? Can you Google one thing? Can you make sure you drink enough water so that tomorrow maybe you can Google a thing? Can you take a 5-minute break from social media and not look at anything? How can you care for yourself while also being part of the world and being aware of the world? I don't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers. But I want you to know this. I love you. We love you. And no justice, no peace. Black Lives Matter.